but why, what was the culpability of the state in all of this?
So
thank you. Go ahead, Dave.
Oh, sorry, Abdurrahman. Yeah, just to clarify that one, the total between the city and state is $36 million. So it was $26 million from the city and $10 million from the state that came previously. And the reason the state paid is because New York State is one of few states in the country that has a law that compensates people who are wrongfully convicted and imprisoned. And that's a major movement of, you know, my partners at the Innocence Project and other organizations to get similar laws passed in the rest of the country.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. David Shaness, civil rights and wrongful conviction lawyer who represented Muhammad Aziz and the family of Khalil Islam. And thank you to Abdurrahman Muhammad, independent scholar, historian, journalist and activist who helped break open this case, didn't let it go for decades. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for a video news production fellowship and a people and culture manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Radio's greatest application is in broadcasting mass entertainment. Probably one of the best ways to get started is to make it a hobby and build an amateur station. It will show you more quickly than anything else whether or not you can succeed in radio.
KBOO, Portland.
A date which will live in infamy.
Tune in to KBOO on election night, Tuesday, November 8th at 6 p.m. for our live midterm election coverage. We'll have coverage that counts from local, county, state, and national races. Our anchors will be with you while the vote tallies come in, and we'll also feature analysis from your favorite KBOO hosts. That's KBOO's live midterm election coverage starting at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, November 8th. Don't miss it.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, nearly 8,000 young Oregonians were not pre-registered to vote due to a software glitch. The abortion rate in Oregon increases 18% post-Roe. And in international news, our own Mel Gertov analyzes the most recent Chinese Communist Party conference. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 1st, 2022. I'm Eric Leuschner. Nearly 8,000 young Oregonians weren't pre-registered to vote because of a software glitch. Secretary of State Shamia Fagan says they discovered the errors on Friday. The scope of the software glitch meant that 7,800 young people weren't pre-registered to vote over the past 6 years. Oregon's motor voter law means that residents who get a license or permit from the DMV are automatically registered to vote. The glitch skipped over many 16 and 17-year-olds and impacted the last three election cycles. Secretary Fagan says the issue is being fixed. She also directed Oregon's county clerks to issue ballots to those voters who will be 18 or older by November 8th. This means the skipped over young voters will be able to cast their ballots in the midterm elections. There are about 3 million registered voters in Oregon, and over 400,000 ballots have already been returned. The election is just 1 week away, and voters can return their ballots by mail or leave them in an official drop box. Ballots postmarked as late as Election Day will still be counted. The number of abortions per month in Oregon went up by 18% in August, following the U.S. Supreme Court's June decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. Abortion without restrictions remains legal in Oregon, and providers already had been reporting an increase in out-of-state residents coming here for the procedure. Now we have more accurate information. Hashtag WeCount is a national reporting project by the Society of Family Planning, an abortion and contraception science group. It's been tracking changes in abortion access since Roe was overturned, collecting data from medical offices, hospitals, telemedicine providers, and clinics. The data do not include self-managed abortions. Hashtag WeCount reports there have been at least 10,000 fewer abortions nationwide since June, a 6% decline. A fall of 22,000 in the most restrictive states has been partially offset by 12,000 more abortions provided elsewhere. In the Pacific Northwest, the biggest changes occurred between April and August, when a near-total ban on abortion went into effect in Idaho. That state saw a 48% decrease in abortions during that period, amounting to 70 fewer abortions. In Oregon, there was an 18% increase in abortions, or 150 more over that time frame, and Washington saw a 5% increase, or 90 additional procedures. The Idaho ban is also affecting patients in Oregon. Eastern Oregon residents who used to have access to abortion at Planned Parenthood in Boise now have to travel 350 miles to get to the closest provider. OHSU has expanded its abortion options with a few methods. They made them available via telehealth, increased the number of clinic spots available, and expanded the amount of operating room time for abortions to help manage the surge in demand. Anecdotally, providers say the majority of patients traveling there for abortions are coming from Idaho, but patients from Texas, Wisconsin, and other states have been noted as well. Women who need to leave their home state for an abortion are facing many obstacles. Appointments can be difficult to schedule, travel times and distances can be extensive, and patients have to contend with the cost of traveling on top of paying for the procedure itself. Research has shown that women who seek an abortion and cannot get one are more likely to live in poverty and are more likely to continue to be exposed to domestic violence than women who do obtain abortions. Prosecutors say an attacker deliberately targeted House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and Republicans still hold an edge 1 week before the midterms. With those stories and more, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Mr. DePapp specifically targeted the Pelosi home to confront Speaker Pelosi.
San Francisco District Attorney Brooke Jenkins announced an attempted murder charge against 42-year-old David DePapp, who was accused of attacking House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband with a hammer at the couple's California home. Speaker Pelosi was in D.C. at the time. The charges were announced after the Department of Justice charged DePapp with federal assault and attempted kidnapping. DePapp reportedly embraced far-right conspiracy theories online, and President Joe Biden cautioned the attack is the latest consequence of the Republican Party's extreme fringe.
It's one thing to condemn the violence, but you can't condemn the violence unless you condemn those people who continue to argue the election was not real, that it's being stolen.
Some members of Congress are calling for increased security, and the Capitol Police are reviewing the break-in. Just 1 week before the midterms that will decide who controls Congress, Republicans have an edge over Democrats in polling. With voters focused on inflation and the risk of a recession, podcaster Joe Rogan suggested the election will be dominated by those in the silent majority.
The red wave that's coming is going to be like the elevator doors opening up in The Shining.
However, California Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell is optimistic.
I'm looking at the early voting numbers in Arizona, in Georgia, and especially in California, and this is going to be a turnout that exceeds any midterm election in our lifetime. And I think that inures in the favor of Democrats.
In the battle for the Senate, Real Clear Politics projects 47 Democratic seats and 53 Republican, and Republicans have a nearly 3-point advantage on a generic congressional ballot. Former President Donald Trump asked the Supreme Court to keep his tax returns hidden from the House Ways and Means Committee. In an emergency filing, Trump reiterated arguments that an appellate court had previously rejected, including that the committee requested his returns for the sake of exposing him. Hillary Clinton is asking a federal court to order Trump to pay her legal fees over a suit he filed alleging she and others conspired to undermine his 2016 campaign with accusations of Russian interference. Trump is currently appealing the dismissal of the lawsuit by a federal trial court. The Supreme Court heard arguments in two potential landmark cases over how colleges and universities consider race in making admissions decisions. The main sticking point is whether the schools are trying hard enough to find race-neutral alternatives in order to achieve diversity. Justice Clarence Thomas dismissed the argument that diversity automatically creates better outcomes.
I guess I don't put much stock in that because I've heard similar arguments in favor of segregation, too.
The conservative wing of the court questioned the lack of clarity around when the need for affirmative action would end, while the court's three liberals stressed the importance of using race as just one part of college admissions decisions. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our interest indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Recent polling finds nearly two-thirds of Latino voters have been exposed to disinformation. Advocates say the trend puts Latino political engagement and voter turnout at risk, and messenger apps play a role. Nadia Romlagon has more in North Carolina.
Recent polling shows more than 60% of Latino voters report exposure to false or unverified information about politics, the COVID vaccine, and abortion. And advocates say the trend puts voter engagement and turnout at risk. North Carolina's population boom over the past decade has mainly come from Latinos, who wield increasing political power. More than 100,000 Latino residents are expected to cast ballots in next week's midterm election. Julio Riviera with the Nalio Educational Fund explains that one in three Latino voters say they believe the disinformation is accurate.
Around two-thirds of Latinos had heard that there is a 5G chip within the COVID vaccine, for example. In this latest round of polling, we saw around 79% had said that they believe now that abortion is illegal nationwide, which is not the case.
Riviera encourages individuals in the Latino community to check facts using websites from official agencies, including information on how, when, and where to vote, before accepting or spreading information shared on social media. He points to nonpartisan Spanish-language voter guides available at votemosnc.com as a resource. Riviera explains Latino communities are highly connected through encrypted messenger apps like WhatsApp, which allow disinformation to spread through a closed chamber of family members, friends, and other trusted contacts.
You can see how easily, with the lack of monitoring in those encrypted messenger apps, with trusted messengers being in the mix, how easily disinformation could potentially spread.
He says some disinformation narratives are geared toward people from certain countries.
We've seen a lot of campaigns aimed at folks coming from communist countries, right? Folks coming from socialist regimes like Venezuela, folks of Cuban descent that seem to be targeted.
The number of Latino eligible voters has increased by nearly 5 million since 2018, comprising more than 60% of the total growth in eligible voters over the past 4 years, according to the Pew Research Center. This is Nadia Romlagon for North Carolina News Service.
The 20th Communist Party conference in China just occurred, seeming to be a win for Xi Jinping and his loyalists. But videos from the party conference shows conflict with his predecessor. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. An article in 2021 in the official Chinese newspaper People's Daily sought to explain Xi Jinping's thoughts on the question, why is political security the basis for state security? The Arab Spring and other efforts at democratization said that commentary showed the danger to China if political security was ignored. And what is political security? Quote, the core of political security is regime security and system security, meaning the unquestioned power of the Chinese Communist Party. At the just concluded 20th Party Congress, we saw that view of political security on full display. It might appear that the Party Congress was a complete triumph for Xi Jinping. He was re-elected to a third term, and his loyalists were elevated to the seven-man standing committee, which is selected by the Politburo of 25. This continued a practice she established at the previous party Congress in 2017, stacking the Politburo and its standing committee with his own men, to which he added another practice, purging rising stars who might challenge his rule. A video also captured an extraordinary moment in the proceedings, the forcible removal of his predecessor, Hu Jintao, who evidently wanted access to certain documents in order, perhaps, to make a critical statement to the attendees. Some analysts think Hu was merely being helped out of the room for health reasons, but a close examination of the video suggests that he resisted and wanted to take certain documents with him. The incident dramatized Xi's unquestioned power. The Party Congress seems to have otherwise proceeded according to Xi's wishes. As a result, it is hard to detect any significant change in China's internal or external directions. Here's my take on the main points in Xi's report. First, no wavering on zero COVID. In fact, Xi elevated one of his favorites, Li Qiang, the Shanghai Party Secretary who presided over the highly unpopular COVID lockdown there. Xi just showed no regard for the rising public anger over constant quarantines. On economic development, Xi promised further reforms, but at the same time an expanding role for the state in the economy, especially in advanced technology. That may help explain the profile of the new party leadership, elderly but well-educated on the technical side. Third, inner party democracy no longer has the prominence it once had in the top leaders' list of priorities. Now it's party and regime security, and a cult of personality that we once thought had been abandoned. That can only mean that repression will remain a mainstay of Xi's politics. Personalistic dictatorship, one prominent China watcher calls it, with dire implications for Xinjiang, Hong Kong, and Tibet. Xi didn't mention those places. And on leadership, photos of the top leaders parading on stage are depressing. No women are on the Politburo for the first time in 25 years. In foreign affairs, no change in policy on Taiwan. Quote, the wheels of history are rolling on toward China's reunification and the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, said Xi. Complete reunification of our country must be realized, and it can without doubt be realized. We will continue, he said, to strive for a peaceful reunification with the greatest sincerity, but we will never promise to renounce the use of force, and we reserve the option of taking all measures necessary, unquote. The theme of peaceful reunification, so long as Taiwan does not move to independence, repeats many such statements in the recent past. It is something worth remembering when we hear predictions and speculation to the effect that China's invasion of Taiwan is imminent. Xi reiterated China's foreign policy principles, respecting other countries, staying independent and peaceful, and opposing, quote, hegemonism and power politics, the Cold War mentality, and double standards. And finally, on Ukraine and nuclear weapons, nothing more or less than the usual on the one hand but on the other, condemning NATO's intervention and, on the other hand, supporting national sovereignty, a reference to Ukraine. Beneath the surface, we see a Chinese leader who aspires to join the pantheon of post-World War II strongmen, most importantly, Chairman Mao. Xi's thoughts are required reading, just as were Mao's and Deng Xiaoping's thoughts. Xi has a clear road to lifetime tenure, and there are no visible challengers to his power. But as one China scholar writes, Xi has not yet at least radically changed China despite his claims to greatness. He has yet to create the conditions necessary for China to become a high-income country. His foreign policy has created a serious backlash abroad, and his domestic agenda is mired in one unimaginative crackdown after the other, unquote. Moreover, by putting himself in such a central role, Xi also becomes more vulnerable. No place to hide, as one scholar writes. He may well need a place to hide as China's economy falters, unemployment among youth rises, the real estate market crashes, and China finds its model of state security has fewer friends abroad than Xi imagines. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for in-depth interviews with the candidates for Portland City Commissioner Position 3, Commissioner Joanne Hardesty and challenger Rene Gonzalez. At 6, it's Trans Positive. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 43 degrees. Tomorrow, rain is also expected with some potential thunderstorms and a high of 48. Today in history, in 1870, the Weather Bureau, later renamed the National Weather Service, makes its first official meteorological forecast in the U.S. The quote of the day is from American photographer Ansel Adams, who said, quote, "There are no rules for good photographs, there are only good photographs." The National Congress of American Indians hosts its annual convention this week in Sacramento, and the issue of tribal disenrollment is pushed by protesters. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The National Congress of American Indians is hosting its annual convention this week in Sacramento. A group of Native people from disenrolled California tribes came out to raise awareness of tribal disenrollment. As Rhonda Lavaldo reports, they're asking the Native Rights Organization and its tribal membership to listen to them.
The annual convention kicked off its General Assembly Monday afternoon as a group gathered outside the convention center to protest tribal disenrollment. About 20 people advocated their cause to NCAI attendees who walked by them. They're calling on NCAI to listen to their stories on disenrollment. Cam Foreman explains why they felt the need to be there.
To say that you support tribal sovereignty while you won't condemn the desecration of ancestors, the banishment and abuse of elders who are sacred, and that's what NCAI says, to protect the Indian Child Welfare Act, yet children are being denied their right to belong, banished from their tribes, homes, and communities. It's not a membership issue. It is a civil and human rights matter, and it needs to be condemned. This has gone on for too long. This is just a small percentage, a tiny bit of the 11,000 that have been disenrolled from their tribes, homes, and communities.
Meanwhile, inside the convention, during the first General Assembly, NCAI President Fawn Sharp conveyed the message that the conference was focusing on tribal sovereignty issues with the theme, Defending Sovereignty Since 1944.
This year's annual convention was going to be all about defending tribal sovereignty. That was before Castro versus Huerta. That was before so many decisions coming out of the U.S. Supreme Court. We knew that we had to gather all of Indian country to strategically talk about tribal sovereignty. So that's what this session is all about and focused on.
Protesters disagree and think the concept is disingenuous because they've been officially ejected from their tribes. The sovereignty theme is taking center stage at this year's convention. A sovereignty run from Oklahoma to California ended in Sacramento as the convention started to raise awareness on attacks on tribal sovereignty, as well as the recent reinstatement of Jim Thorpe's 1912 Olympic wins. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
The National Congress of American Indians told National Native News it does not have a comment to provide at this time regarding tribal disenrollment. The Speaker of the Navajo Nation Council faces disciplinary action after a photo surfaced of him allegedly intoxicated during a recent family trip. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, a bill has been introduced that would strip him of his leadership position.
The photo shows Navajo Nation Council Speaker Seth Damon slumped over and appearing inebriated while sitting in front of a gambling machine in Las Vegas. The image, which Damon called unauthorized, recently circulated on social media. He told the council that he was in fact intoxicated, and in a statement said he accepts responsibility for the incident and apologized to the Navajo people. But he stopped short of stepping aside as speaker and will instead let council delegates decide his fate. Legislation introduced last week would put Damon on indefinite unpaid leave and require the approval of two-thirds of the council. If it's passed, chairs of four council committees will rotate as Speaker pro tem. Damon was on a family vacation to Las Vegas for the Indian National Finals Rodeo to support Navajo athletes when the photo was taken. He said he was not on official Navajo Nation business at the time and spent no tribal funds. Damon leads the tribe's legislative branch and is in his second term as speaker. He's running unopposed for his seat on the council in the November 8th election. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff, Arizona.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
This month is National Palliative and Hospice Care Month, and experts would like to raise awareness and explain some misconceptions. Suzanne Potter has the details in California.
November is National Hospice and Palliative Care Month, but a lot of people confuse the two, so experts say they'd like to clear up some myths. Palliative care is designed to keep a patient comfortable at all stages of an illness. Hospice care is only for people with 6 months or less to live. Dr. Shandana Banerjee with the City of Hope says it's a myth that hospice is the doorway to dying.
Patients that sign on to hospice right when they get eligible for it at 6 months or less to live usually have an excellent quality of life, and many times their lifespan is actually prolonged by a little.
Research shows that most people wait to enter hospice until very late in the disease process, often within several weeks of death. A team for either palliative or hospice care may include a physician, a nurse, a social worker, and a chaplain. Many people mistakenly think that hospice is an actual place, whereas it is actually a suite of services that are most often delivered at home, at a hospital, or in a nursing facility. Robert Drake, a former hospice and palliative care chaplain, is director of medical outreach at the nonprofit Compassion and Choices. He says people may think they can't afford palliative or hospice care, but it's actually covered under many forms of insurance.
Hospice care is paid for by Medicare, and when a person does ultimately die, it allows for 13 months of bereavement care free for the family.
In 2019, California established a task force to study how to create a statewide long-term care insurance fund. The task force's first report is due in January. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says 1.6 million Americans used hospice care in 2018. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Utah officials began taking applications this week for a new program that would pay up to $1 per square foot to replace water-guzzling grass lawns with drought-resistant landscaping. Earlier this year, the Utah legislature approved $5 million to fund a statewide grass removal rebate program. Mark Richardson has more on how this program could help make Utah more drought-resistant.
Utah has been in a long-term drought for decades, and state officials continue to look for ways to conserve the state's shrinking water supply. One of the newest programs at the Utah Department of Natural Resources is a plan to offer residents money to remove their lawns. Starting this week, the state is taking applications for a program to pay up to $1 a square foot for turf to replace water-guzzling grass with drought-resistant landscaping. Michael Sanchez with the State Division of Water Resources says cultivating a lush green lawn in Utah bone dry climate is a major water waster.
We do live in a semi-arid state. As you know, Utah has a different landscape than Kentucky, where you have bluegrass everywhere. It's just matching our landscapes to where we actually live.
According to data from the Division of Water Resources, Utah's system of reservoirs ended the 2022 water year at just 36% of capacity. Officials say while Utah had a better than average snowpack this season, it wasn't enough to keep up with the state's growing demand for water. The Utah legislature has approved a $5 million expenditure to fund a statewide grass removal rebate program. Participants will have a year to complete their landscaping project, which includes removing the old turf and replacing it with drought-resistant vegetation approved for their part of the state. Sanchez says swapping out the turf, even in small areas, can bring considerable savings.
Just based on a quarter acre lot, the amount of water used on that lot is about 3,000 gallons with each watering. So just moving to something less water intensive could be something that could save a lot of water.
The state is starting this fall with a pilot program in Washington County, including residents in St. George, Washington, Santa Clara, and Ivins, but it will be fully implemented by next spring. Similar turf removal programs have been successful in neighboring states, where cities like Scottsdale and Las Vegas have swapped millions of square feet of grass for water-efficient landscapes to save billions of gallons of water. I'm Mark Richardson for Utah News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 1st, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertoff. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Ramlagan, Suzanne Potter, Mary Sherman, and Mark Richardson. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member or support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth, featuring interviews with Portland Commissioner candidates Joanne Hardesty and Renee Gonzalez.
KBOO News In-Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In-Depth. Today, we'll hear two interviews I conducted with the two candidates for Portland City Commissioner Position 3, Renee Gonzalez and Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. First, I spoke with Renee Gonzalez. Gonzalez comes from the private sector, opening a law firm in 2012, serving as a managing partner for that firm and a subsidiary software company. Gonzalez also helped build the largest youth soccer club in Portland and served the Children's Museum and the Library Foundation. Now here is my conversation with candidate Renee Gonzalez. So thanks for taking the time to talk with KBOO today. You're challenging Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty for the Position 3 seat. When you reflect on the campaign so far, are there things you wish you could change, things you wish you could do differently?
Oh, thanks so much for having me. You know, we're at a time of real intensity. And so anytime that we've added fuel to the fire, you know, I don't wish we weren't, and trying to calm things down is really, you know, the way I think we should be handling ourselves in this election. So, you know, hopefully I Portlanders perceive that I've tried to engage in the issues in a way that is fair. And even if folks disagree, there's not screaming and hollering.